cancel off that. Go ahead and turn to 1 Kings. 1 Kings, we will get there eventually. It will happen, I promise. I had fun. You know, I think I've told you guys this many times before. I used to spend so much time trying to come up with cute little fun ways to name lessons. But this lesson was quite easy because we are talking about 1 Kings 18. And the lesson title is, Who's Your Dance Partner? Right? Who are you going to be dancing with? And so that again, that kind of gives people a little bit of a shock. But we'll get to that eventually. So in relationship to dancing, I have to ask some questions this morning, right? What do ghosts dance to? What do ghosts dance to? Soul music, right? Everybody knows that, soul music. What kind of dance do cars do at the disco? Break dance. What kind of dance do mothers like best? Mambo. How do you make a tissue dance? Put a little boogie in it. That's right. Somebody got one right. Good job. And Hunter will know this one. If he doesn't, I'll be shocked. Why didn't the skeleton dance at the disco? You told this joke. Yeah. Because he had no body to dance with, right? The skeleton. Say, Mike, dance jokes? Really? It's a Church of Christ. We can't talk about dancing. It doesn't happen. We're about to look at a story from 1 Kings that actually does talk a little bit about dancing in a different way. It's a story some of you are familiar with, maybe not the thought of dance, but the story itself helps us to realize how important our choices are. What kind of person are we going to be is based on, in a lot of cases, the choices that we make. Last week I talked about Onesimus. I know it wasn't from Hebrews, but literally the way that story came about, or that lesson came about, was I flipped my Bible open to get to Hebrews, and I stopped at Philemon, or I opened it to Philemon, and I thought, well, I haven't read Philemon in a long time, so I read it, and I went, I'm going to preach on this. I mean, I know it's right before Hebrews, so it wasn't from Hebrews 11:32, but let's look at Hebrews 11:32. We're back to Hebrews, especially as Bill Deathridge is going to be here this Wednesday, and he has Hebrews 11, and I have a feeling I'm getting past the first six or seven verses, knowing Bill, but incredible, incredible chapter. Hebrews 11:32, and what more shall I say? Right, the author writes, I don't have time, which we found time, to talk about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, about David and Samuel, and then this morning, the prophets. Right, we're going to talk about one of the great prophets of the Old Testament, one of the greatest spokespersons for God ever, and that is Elijah. So let me set things up for you this morning. Here's a shock by this, and it's probably in your notes. But the people of God are sinning. The Israelites are in rebellion against God. Right? I know, it's a shocker. And this is where Elijah is at, right? That they have been in this rebellion. Whether it's Israel, whether it's Judah, they can't seem to get things right. And there are times when we may relate to this, where we want to do what's right and we don't do it. Even Paul wrote that in the book of Romans, when he said, I want to do what's right, but I don't always do what's right. I want to say what's right, but it doesn't always come out of my mouth. And so there's this struggle that takes place. Now, there are three kings right before Ahab, one of which is his father. But the king's names are Elah, Zimri, and Omri. All right? And about each one of these three kings, especially what they're going to say about Ahab, is that they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. That they did not do what God was expecting them to do. And so look at 1 Kings chapter 16, verses 29 through 33. Here we get introduced to Ahab, and he's a vital part of this particular story. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, who was the son of Omri, became king of Israel. And he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. I mean, what a nice record to own. I mean, you talk about having a record, right? You think, I want to be the guy that lifts the most weights, or I want to be the guy that shot the most 300s, or I want to be the guy that has the most hole-in-ones, but I don't want to be the guy that did the most evil in the eyes of the Lord. But that's Ahab. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but this is what's interesting to me. He also married Jezebel. We know that name well. Daughter of Ethbaal. You'll notice the last part of that name is in relationship to Baal. King of the Sidonians. And began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did all the kings of Israel before him. So Ahab is not a good guy. He has done more evil in the eyes of the Lord than anyone else. And part of the description as to why Ahab is considered evil is that he married Jezebel, a Sidonian, right? It never ceases to amaze me how often the Israelites were influenced by the nations around them. That they were brought into their religion, brought into their worship of their gods and their idols, and it caused such destruction in the life of the Israelites. They're constantly being cared for by God. They're constantly being fought for by God, and yet they still want to chase after these other gods. There's a lesson there for us as well, right? Living in the country that we live in. And focusing on the things that this world sometimes focuses on, and it catches us. But remember, we talked about Jephthah last month, right? Because God was judging the Israelites for the sins that they were committing under Jephthah, right? Under his rule, or about to be ruled. Look at Judges chapter 10, verse 6. And I think this is kind of interesting, because I want to bring this up for a reason, so stay with me. The Israelites, again, did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They served the Baals and the Ashtoreths and the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, the gods of the Philistines. And because the Israelites forsook the Lord and no longer served him, he became angry with them. So if we go back before Ahab, you know, you have these same situations and these same problems that are taking place. Judges 10, 11, and 12, a little further down the road. The Lord replied, when the Egyptians, the Amorites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, and the Sidonians, the Amalekites and the Maonites oppressed you, you cried to me for help. Did I not save you from their hands? And if you'll remember, we talked about there's no need to fear, right? Jephthah is here, the underdog. Remember, his mother was a prostitute, and he was kicked out of his household and ended up in the woods, basically in the wilderness, right? And then was asked to serve the people and to beat the enemies down, to fight for God. Jephthah became the hero, right? But it was against the Sidonians. And I want to bring this up because I think it's really important to the story. Sidon was the firstborn of Canaan. Of the Canaanites, right? Who was Canaan? He was the grandson of Noah. The guy Noah. He's in Hebrews 11 as a great man of faith. It's not like Canaan and it's not like Sidon didn't have the opportunity to have a heritage of faith. Sometimes we look at these foreign lands or we look at these foreign nations and we say, well, how sad is it that they didn't have an opportunity to know about the true and living God? No, they had the opportunity to know about the true and living God. They just perverted that relationship. It was their fault that they left God. It was their fault that they chose other gods. It wasn't like they didn't have those opportunities. So God's judgment against them is for their rebellion, their disobedience, and their lack of love in following him. So it only makes sense that we understand that. So Noah is Sidon's great-grandfather. But the Sidonians left God's teaching, and they chased after idols. So the Sidonians became a thorn in the flesh of Israel because of their gods and because of their idols. And there's another great guy, right? Another great man of God that we read about, that Jim just talked about just a little while ago, that made a few mistakes too. And his name is Solomon. Look at 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. We're going to see another common theme. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, and Sidonians and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. And there's this cool word in the Bible, nevertheless, right? Which is essentially, regardless of anything that God has said, or regardless of anything your parents have said, regardless of anything that anybody that has any wisdom has said, I'm going to do the opposite. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them, speaking of his wives in love. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David, his father, had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the who? Sidonians. And Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David, his father, had done. So David danced before the Lord, and Solomon danced with foreign gods. David picked his partners poorly. Right? You have chosen poorly, to quote a movie that I'll quote in a minute. Bad choices. You know, we talked to the kids in class this morning. We talked about the wisdom. You know, in James, he talks about there's wisdom that comes from God, and you can recognize that wisdom from God because it's related to peace, and it's related to joy, and it's related to good things. But there's also a wisdom that comes from Satan. Right? That there are things that Satan puts in our path, those experiences, that knowledge that we have, but those experiences that lead to evil. And that's what happens here in the life of Solomon. Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David, his father, had done. Now, I think that's interesting because we see that there's times when David made those mistakes, but I can't find anywhere in my Bible where David ever chased after other gods. Right? He had sin in his life. He made mistakes in his life, but he never worshiped after or chased after other gods and worshiped them. Ahab has married Jezebel, a Sidonian, right? Because of her influence on Ahab, the nation of Israel is in trouble. Well, Mike, what does that have to do with us? Everything. Because we have to pick our friendships, right? Carefully. We have to choose the ones that we spend time with. You know, I've said this 1,000 times, and I don't know if I'm pretty sure I've mentioned it here before, but we talk about this all the time with teenagers, and we say, yeah, look, your influence has to be based on being a thermostat, not a thermometer, right? A thermostat is important. A Christian has to be a thermostat. The way that works is I set the temperature on a thermostat and the whole room is changed based on what I change the thermostat to, right? So I need to be a thermostat. When I walk into the room, I need to show the presence of God. I need to represent God in such a way that it changes those around me and not be like a thermometer. Because a thermometer, you drop it in and it changes according to what temperature it's put in. If it's put in 80 degrees, it becomes 80 degrees, or it shows the temperature of 80 degrees. So we can't be influenced by others. Here you're seeing great men of God, people who are supposed to lead the Israelites, being influenced by those around them. You know, I told the kids in class, pick your friendships carefully. You've been told that your entire life. Have we not heard that our entire lives growing up? Pick your friendships carefully. Pick those that we spend time with very carefully. Ahab's married Jezebel, right? Elijah asks God in this scenario, as we set up for this, to send a drought. God obliges. It hasn't rained for 3 years. Now, Ahab and Jezebel hate Elijah. They're trying to hunt him down. They're trying to kill him. They're so angry at all the things that Elijah has done. And so we're going to start here in 1 Kings 18. Hopefully you got my email that said bring your Bibles, because I didn't put up there, Shane, you get a little bit of a break. And I appreciate Shane so much. You know, the other night I was running the PowerPoint, and I said to myself mentally, do not forget to thank Shane for reading my mind. Right? Because there are times when he's watching my PowerPoint and he's got to pay attention to how my mind works. And that's Not a small feat. So I appreciate Shane being in charge of PowerPoint, because I flipped that back and forth five or six times with Barrett's. It wasn't last week. It was the week before. And I was like, is that where he wants to be? I don't know. And I was going back and forth trying to go, where does he want me to be on which slide? So you've done an incredible job. There is not a slide for 1 Kings 18. It's a long passage, and I want to comment as we go through it. So we've set this up. Ahab is chasing after. Jezebel is hating, and Ahab is hating on Elijah. Elijah feels alone. Elijah feels like things aren't going his way. Obadiah is mentioned here in just a minute. Obadiah and Elijah meet, and Elijah tells Obadiah, arrange a meeting, and I will definitely meet with Ahab. Okay, so here's verse 16 of chapter 18. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, go meet Ahab, told him that Elijah wants to meet, and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, is that you, you troubler of Israel? Okay, time out. Elijah's the troubler of Israel? Really? You're going to turn around and tell me that Elijah's the bad guy when you have married into a nation that lifts up other gods and other idols? You have done evil in the sight of the Lord. You have caused all of these problems. And yet it's Elijah's fault for living out the will of God in his life? Have you ever faced those situations before? Have you ever been the conscience among your friendships and they go, dude, quit causing problems? How am I causing problems? By doing the right thing? By telling you guys we're not going to go there? We're not going to do those things? We're not going to be stupid? I'm being the troubler? I don't think I'm being the troubler. I feel like that's exactly what happens here. And Elijah responds accordingly. I have not made trouble for Israel, Elijah replied, but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands. You have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. 850-1. That's not bad odds, considering the fact Gideon had 300 guys against about 125,000. I'm thinking that's not too bad, but it's still an overwhelming scenario. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel, verse 20, assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, and here comes the lesson, right? How long will you waver between two opinions? Now what's cool is this Hebrew word waver. If you go down and look in verse 26... real quickly, for me it's on the next page, right at the end of verse 26, and they danced around the altar they had made. Do you know the word waver and the word danced is the exact same word? So the word in the Hebrew means to dance, right? To be led by another, to be in a situation where someone is leading you around. Now as a male, the male usually leads the female in certain dances. And if the woman is willing and a good partner and understands that particular dance, for me, you know, when Karen and I will occasionally go two-stepping, I got to count out loud sometimes. I know that sounds weird because it's a two-step. One, two, one, two, right? It's not that hard. But I'm not much on dancing. I don't go dancing very often. But when we go, we go to this little place called the Grand Old Opland. Right, it's not the Grand Old Opry, it's the Grand Old Opland. It's in Opland, Texas. It's an old gymnasium, and you're not allowed to drink, and you're not allowed to smoke, and you're not allowed to cuss, and you're not allowed to have tobacco. Right? And people go there and they play some old fashioned music, and it's like you're in 1950. And it's very enjoyable, very fun, and you get to kind of do a little dancing. Well, we don't do that very much. So for me, I'm thinking, and Karen will say, oh, you got to say what you're doing out loud, right? Because I'll step on her foot. But after a while, we kind of get the hang of things. Well, our niece is an extremely good dancer. And she told me, she said, let me tell you something. Where you put your hand on me and kind of put a little pressure, you're going to tell me where you want me to go, and I'll just follow wherever you want to go, right? And you can lead me in that exact way. Doesn't God not do that with us? Sometimes God leads us where we don't want to go. You know, sometimes, for me, I'll stay way on the outside or right into the middle. We try not to get in anybody else's way, right? We want to stay right in a spot where we don't bother anybody else. And sometimes God leads us where he wants us to bother some folks. He wants us to be influential. Maybe we want to stay away from the trouble or whatever, but God leads us. Jeff Walling wrote a book, Dancing with God, one of the most incredible books I ever read. And it basically was about God leading us through this life, right? That our footsteps go where his footsteps go. And we follow where God leads us and where he wants to take us. And I think that's really powerful. So here, how long, Elijah says, will you dance between two opinions? Don't be dancing over here and then dancing over here. He says, if the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. Get off the fence. I mean, that's what he's essentially saying. You can't dance with all these different dance partners and let them lead you all over. You need to choose today who you're going to serve. But the people, it says, said nothing. So Elijah says to them, I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left. But Baal has 450 prophets. That's not really necessarily true, but I think he's not the only one of the prophets left, but he's the only one standing up right now for what's right. Get two bulls for us, he says. Let them choose one for themselves. Who? The prophets of Baal get to choose one of the bulls. And let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood and not set fire to it. That'll happen in a minute. I'll prepare the other bull and I'll put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and then I'll call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he's God. Challenge, Elijah says. Let's have a contest. We're going to see whose God is God. And so we're going to see which God, the God of the lightning and the thunder that Psalms talks about, the God of fire, and this same Baal, who is also known for thunder and lightning and fire, who's going to answer? And the people said, hey, what you say is good, right? Two thumbs up if you're texting, right? Give the thumb up. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call in the name of your God, but do not light the fire. So they took the bull given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. O Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. You know, I don't know why this always hurts my heart. To think about how many times my friends call on Baal. They call on God, but they call on their own gods, right? They want pleasure and they want success and they want the things that the world offers, which those gods of those pleasures are the things that they're appeasing to. But then when something bad happens, all of a sudden, then they want to call Jehovah, like Elijah is doing, right? Then they want the true God, and then when they get an answer that might somewhat work, then they just go back to what they've always done. And it hurts my heart because it really drives me crazy to hear the philosophies and the theologies of people that I spend time with and say, no, that's not how God works. You're dancing with idols and you're dancing with other gods, and then you expect God to suddenly just lead you down this rosy path, and it just doesn't work that way until you give your life to him. But here's what he says. There's no responses. No one answered. Of course there's no response. No one's going to answer. There's no one there. And they danced around the altar that they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout loud. I cannot hear the word taunt and not think of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I don't know about you guys, but that's to me the funniest. You know, the French guys that are up on the castle wall, I shall taunt you a second time. Your mother smells like elderberries. You know, I mean, I don't know if you remember that movie or not. If you hadn't seen it in a while, to me, that's just one of the funniest movies when you hear the word taunt, right? So Elijah's taunting them. You know, I'm sure he doesn't say, your mother smells like Astoreth, you know, but anyway. Shout louder, he says. Surely he is God. Perhaps he's deep in thought, or he's busy, or he's traveling, or he's sleeping and must be awakened. In the Hebrew, he actually says, maybe he's sitting on the toilet. Maybe he's a little busy right now. He'll be done with his business in a moment, and he'll come back out, and maybe then he'll answer you. right? Maybe he's taking a nap. Maybe he's fixing a sandwich. You know, put it into some more modern day. Maybe he's on a video game. You know, maybe he's texting right now. Maybe just give him a second, and he'll give you an answer, right? That's what he's going to do. So they shouted louder. They slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, because blood needed to flow for the god Baal. But they did not answer, right? He did not answer. Midday passed. They continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. So he gives them all day long, from morning till noon. At noon, he starts to taunt them, right? And then no one paid attention, it says. No one answered. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." So they came to him. He repaired the altar of the Lord, which was in ruins. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he dug a trench around it large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, laid it on the wood. He said to them, "Fill 4 large jars with water, pour it on the offering and on the wood." No tricks, right? I want to make sure you guys are paying attention. You know, if I'm going to light a fire at our house, if we're going to have a bonfire, right, the worst thing I could do is dig a trench around it and pour water all over it. Right, I want to get dry wood and all that stuff. But that's Elijah's trying to make sure they understand that God is going to take care of this. And there's no tricks up his sleeve. So they pour 4 large jars with water, poured on the offering, on the wood. "Do it again," he said. And they did it again. "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And this time the water ran down around the altar, even filled the trench. At the time of sacrifice. So this is happening 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes before. I mean, they've been dancing and going crazy all day and slicing and cutting and wanting Baal to answer. And so within 15, 20, 30 minutes, Elijah begins to pray. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today, excuse me, you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I've done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know," and I love this, "that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." It's all for them, right? I'm so thankful that God is patient. Aren't you? You ever been in that time in your life, especially when you're younger, maybe it's now, where you're thinking, "Man, I really want to get it figured out." And God is patient. And I see this, and the person that I am now says, "Man, I wish God would just lay down the law to him." And then I'm reminded, boy, I'm glad he didn't do that to me whenever I rebelled against him. I mean, I'm thankful that I was given some time to get my life right, to repent of my attitude, to repent of my heart. But God is still working, and he's trying to turn their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice. You know, all I can think about is Indiana Jones. Y'all remember that scene in that movie where Harrison Ford says, "Turn, close your eyes, don't look." And that fire comes down and judges those folks. And it was at the time, it was one of the most incredible movies ever. You know, the special effects were out of this world. Now you watch it and you kind of go, "Wow, that's we've come a long way with special effects," right? But they decided that they were going to challenge God in that movie to do what only a priest could do, what only the high priest could do, and only at a certain point in time to touch and to do, you know, with the ark. And I know that's a movie, but that scene has always stuck with me when I think of judgment and I think of God and his power. And I wonder how anyone present on this day could have ever rebelled against God again. But we know they did. Because we're going to, you know, we're not going to talk about it this morning, but if you keep reading, they just go right back into rebellion. Another generation shows up and they forget who God is. And oftentimes you hear teenagers, I know when I'm teaching class, they'll say, "I wish God still acted like that." And sometimes I want to go, "Do you really?" Because I don't think you do. You know, for us to want God to appear sometimes the way he did in the Old Testament would be what we feel like, oh, I need that for my faith. And yet, the New Testament constantly tells us, hey, better are you. Your faith is greater and stronger, and more value is going to be given to your faith that you see without, or that you believe without seeing. That you trust the Word, that you trust what God is saying. And that's tough sometimes. But see, we're given all these stories to remind us that God did act in different ways. It's the value of Hebrews. In the past, God spoke to the prophets. God spoke through the prophets. He spoke to the people in various and sundry ways. But in these last days, Hebrews 1 says, he speaks to us through his Son. Because his Son was powerful and incredible and amazing. Right? And even though Jesus did what Jesus did on the cross, his whole life was a commentary on God's love and on God's patience, that he was waiting and giving the Israelites time to repent for the umpteenth thousandth time, feels like. But all these miracles that happened, these amazing feats, I mean, these are the ancestors of folks who saw the Red Sea parted. Saw the miracles, right, in Egypt. You know, watched Moses tap on a rock and another time speak to a rock and water pours forth. You know, saw the cloud, the pillar over their heads every single day, every single night. Hey, the cloud moves, we move. The cloud stops, we stop. I mean, they saw all of those things with their eyes. And yet you have a constant commentary of rebellion against God and the chasing after other gods. And I think this morning it's so important for us to realize that we can get caught up in this world and start paying attention to what the world's given us to a point that we may start following their thoughts and start thinking like they think and do what they do instead of what God has done for us. And we have the benefit of all the stories written down for us and all the teaching and all the incredible things that we see. I mean, I get to do Hebrews chapter 12, you know, a week from Wednesday. The writer talks about Hebrews 11, by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith, and reminds us of all the stories. And in Hebrews 11, 30, I ain't even got time to tell you about all these other stories. But when it all comes down to, Hebrews chapter 12 says, keep your eyes on Jesus. All right? You've got to focus on him. Because if you take your eyes off of him, you're going to miss all of this. The most important part of life. And so we get to this story. Those people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. The fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, burned up the wood, the stones, the soil, and it licked up the water in the trench. And when the people saw this, they fell prostrate and they cried, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." They're convinced he wins the challenge, right? Then Elijah commanded them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away." They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. God wins. Somebody says, "Elijah won." No, God wins. Elijah's just representing God. And the people turn their hearts back, and yet you just read a few more chapters, and they go right back to where they're at. And it just is astounding to me. Astounding to me. But here's the thing that's amazing, right? When we look at the stories, you got to be reminded that the people didn't have this book, right? They didn't have this. They relied on the priests. They relied on the high priest. They relied on the leaders of Israel to put them in the right place. Even the king, which was not God's idea. It was the people's idea. But these kings are evil kings. They do evil in the sight of God, in evil in the sight of the Lord. And they do terrible things. You know what's amazing about this story is Ahab is not even automatically killed and judged and thrown out. Elijah essentially says to Ahab, "Hey, did you see what happened? Hey, you want some time to get this right?" You know, and Ahab still chooses to disobey God. Instead, he should have, you know, put Jezebel to death. Oh, kill your wife? You know, it's like, not because she's a heifer, but because she, you know, that is so funny how that just keeps coming up in so many things. I mean, Dan was talking about something. Now you guys had to be here for that. But anyway, I just think if you don't know the heifer joke, ask me afterward. It's just amazing to me that they chose so poorly, and because of their poor choices, they led Israel, not only the kings led Israel down the wrong path, but they led themselves down the wrong path. Don't you think it's important this morning that we get off the fence? I mean, that we say, who am I going to choose today? You know, who am I going to serve today? Who's my dance partner, right? Who's going to lead me and who's going to, you know, flow through this incredible life? And I'm not talking about dirty, yucky dancing. I'm talking about this dance with God that is pure and wholesome and good, and that He's leading and we're talking and we're conversing and we're listening and we're hearing the things that God has for our lives. That's, you know, if you want to call it a waltz, call it a waltz. But it's just a moment in time where we're spending time with the Father. Because I think every single day we face situations where we've got to choose. We really do. Joshua said it this way, and I appreciate Brad reading that for us this morning. If you don't want to serve the Lord, and I love how Joshua says this, if you don't want to serve the Lord, then choose for yourselves today whom you're going to serve. You may serve the gods that your ancestors worshiped when they lived on the other side of the Euphrates River, or you may serve the gods of the Amorites who lived in this land. But for me, as for our house, for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. And there are so many who choose differently. And that just blows me away. And I think it's scary to know that Satan has done such a great job of deceiving this world into thinking that what they serve and who they serve, dead idol worship, is somehow going to make their lives better, just like it was back here. Just blows me away. So how do we fix that, right? Well, we stand up, we live for what we know is right. And we show that example in the way we live our lives and the dedication that we have for God. And so we've got to choose rightly every single day. And it's tough at times. But I'd love for you to remember this story when it comes to making those big choices. Are the things we're doing glorifying God and getting my kids and my family closer to Him, or farther away? If it's farther away, then I choose God every time. I choose that situation over any other situation. And that's tough in this world. Okay, but I got to tell you, getting into the Word, understanding these stories, it's just going to increase our faith, because I love what Romans says. Faith comes from what is heard, and what is heard comes from the preaching of Christ. Right? That's where our faith comes from, here, right? Not out there, but here. And this story this morning should help us to be reminded, right? We need to choose our dance partners well. So